Continuing with the theme of the Four Noble Truths, with the overall theme of the Fourth Satipatthana. Going to just read a very short excerpt from a sutta that Debbie mentioned in the Anguttaras, actually, just as a slight variation on the theme of the Four Noble Truths, a variation from the usual rendition of the second and third Noble Truths, the truth of the origin of suffering and the truth of the cessation of suffering. As pretty much everybody knows, usually the second truth of the origin of suffering is phrased as the origin is due to the three kinds of craving, kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. And the third noble truth is usually phrased in terms of the cessation of that same craving. And this is just one passage that puts it in terms of dependent origination, the arising of suffering, and then the cessation of suffering in terms of dependent origination, which Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote says is pretty much the only place in the canon that this variation appears. So just as a way of doing it, it's within a somewhat longer sutta called the Sectarian, which for the most part is the Buddha refuting or explaining and then refuting three major sectarian views, and then he goes to expound his own teaching, including this little section on the Four Noble Truths. When it was said, these are the Four Noble Truths. Sorry?
Did you say which sutta it was?
It was in the Anguttara Threes, called the Sectarian. Oh, okay, sorry. I didn't say the number. He's expecting. Sorry. Number 61. 61-1. Today's March 22nd. When it was said, these are the Four Noble Truths. This, bhikkhus, is the Dhamma taught by me that is unrefuted, uncensured by wise ascetics and Brahmins. For what reason was that said? In dependence on the six elements, the descent of a future embryo occurs. When the descent takes place, there is name and form. With name and form as condition, there are the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, there is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Now it is for one who feels that I proclaim, this is suffering, and this is the origin of suffering, and this is the cessation of suffering, and this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish are suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. This is called the noble truth of suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? With ignorance as condition, volitional activities come to be. With volitional activities as condition, consciousness. With consciousness as condition, name and form. With name and form as condition, the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, existence. With existence as condition, birth. With birth as condition, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish come to be. Such is this origin of this whole mass of suffering. This is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? With the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of volitional activities. with the cessation of volitional activities, cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness, cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form, cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, cessation of contact. With the cessation of contact, cessation of feeling. With the cessation of feeling, cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of existence. With the cessation of existence, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is called the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is called the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So, just wanting to put that out there as an alternative variation. And, we haven't really talked about dependent origination much this past few months, so this is probably as much as we'll get into with it. It being very subtle. Ajahn Sumedho spent a whole winter retreat, I think, doing that once with the dependent origination. So mostly this evening, question.
More of an observation that right view is most of the time talked about in terms of Four Noble Truths, but in the Nidana Samhita, it's often equated to the arising and cessation of dependent origination. So they're indirectly sort of equated.
That's true. Yeah, right view has kind of a number of different permutations and aspects to it, both mundane and super mundane. Yeah. Yeah, they do relate with the Four Noble Truths. Okay, anything else before we move on to Ajahn Chah reading? So yeah, the main reading this evening is from Food for the Heart, and chapter 32, entitled The Four Noble Truths. It, you know, in the style of Ajahn Chah, it's not like an academic presentation of the Four Noble Truths as you would expect. So it kind of moves in and out of that theme and into related things that strike him as useful teachings. Having been a teacher for many years now, I've been through my share of difficulties. At present, there are altogether about 40 branch monasteries of my monastery, Wat Nong Pa Phong. But even these days, I have followers who are hard to teach.
Can I just interject a bit?
Yeah.
That this talk was given at Manjushri Institute, and there was monastics and lay people there, and then the abbot of the modern Tibetan monastery. And the teacher was there, and there was other ordained people there, as well as a lot of lay people. And there's beginning their community. And they had their place was, in terms of a derelict mansion, it made chitters look like a shed.
Big.
It's big.
Where is it from?
Cumbria. It's in the north. Up near the Lake District.
And you had mentioned that he saw you sometime later and remarked that this was... That you had met the abbot sometime later?
No, I met another monk.
Oh, another monk.
Another monk who was there at that talk. And in India, I was in Sarnath. And he was, when he found out that I was there. Student of Ajahn Chah, he was really excited because he was actually at that talk. And so that's nice to remember that day. It was really inspiring.
One other question. Yeah. Who is translating Prajahn Shah?
That would be Joseph Campbell. Barker at the time.
Okay. But even these days I have followers who are hard to teach. Some know how to practice but don't bother. Some don't know how and don't try to find out. I don't know what to do with them. Why do human beings have minds like this? Being ignorant is not so good, but even when I tell them, they don't listen. I don't know what more I can do. People are so full of doubts in their practice. They're always doubting. They all want to go to Nibbana, but they don't want to walk the path. It's baffling. When I tell them to meditate, they're afraid, or if not afraid, then just plain sleepy. Mostly, they like to do the things I don't teach. When I have spoken with other teachers of the Dhamma, they have told me that their followers are just the same. This is the pain of being a teacher. The teaching I offer you today is a way to solve problems in the present moment, in this present life. Some people say that they have so much work to do, they have no time to practice the Dhamma. What can we do, they ask. I tell them that practicing meditation is just like breathing. While working, we breathe. While sleeping, we breathe. While sitting down, we breathe. We have time to breathe because we see the importance of the breath. In the same way, if we see the importance of meditation practice, we will find the time to practice. Have any of you ever suffered? Have you ever been happy? Right here is the truth. This is where you must practice the Dhamma. Who is it who is happy? The mind is happy. Who suffers? The mind suffers. Wherever these things arise, that's where they cease. What is the cause of these things? This is our problem. If we know suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering, we can solve the problem. There are two kinds of suffering, ordinary suffering and the extraordinary kind. Ordinary suffering is the suffering that is the inherent nature of conditions. Standing is suffering, sitting is suffering, lying down is suffering. Even the Buddha experienced these things. He experienced comfort and pain, but he recognized them as conditions in nature. He knew how to overcome these ordinary natural feelings of comfort and pain through understanding their true nature. Because he understood this, quote, natural suffering, those feelings didn't upset him. The important kind of suffering is the second kind, the suffering that creeps in from the outside, the extraordinary suffering. If we are sick, we may have to get an injection from the doctor. When the needle pierces the skin, there is some pain, which is only natural. When the needle is withdrawn, that pain disappears. This is like the ordinary kind of suffering. It's no problem. Everybody experiences it. The extraordinary suffering is the suffering that arises from what we call upadana, grasping onto things. This is like having an injection with a syringe filled with poison. This is no longer an ordinary kind of pain. It is the pain that ends in death. Wrong view, not knowing the impermanent nature of all conditioned things, is another kind of problem. Conditioned things are the realm of samsara. Not wanting things to change, if we think like this, we must suffer. When we think that the body is ourselves or belongs to us, we are afraid when we see it change. Suppose we lost something. If we thought that object was really ours, we would brood over it. If we couldn't see it as a conditioned thing conforming to the laws of nature, we would experience suffering. But if you breathe in and don't breathe out, or breathe out and don't breathe in, can you live? Conditioned things must naturally change in this way. To see this is to see the Dhamma, to see anicca, change. We live dependent on this change. When we know how things are, then we can let go of them. The practice of Dhamma is to develop an understanding of the way things are so that suffering doesn't arise. If we think mistakenly, we put ourselves at odds with the world, at odds with the Dhamma and with the truth. Suppose you are sick and have to go into hospital. Most people think, please don't let me die, I want to get better. This is wrong thinking. it will lead to suffering. You have to think to yourself, if I recover, I recover. If I die, I die. This is right thinking, because you can't ultimately control conditions. If you think like this, whether you die or recover, you can't go wrong. You don't have to worry. Wanting to get better at all costs and afraid of dying, such is the mind that doesn't understand conditions. You should think, if I get better, that's fine, and if I don't get better, that's fine too. This way we have tuned ourselves into the way things are. The Buddha saw all this clearly. His teaching is always relevant, never outdated. It's still as true as it ever was. By taking this teaching to heart, we can gain the reward of peace and well-being. In the teachings, there is the reflection on not-self. This is not myself. This does not belong to me. But people don't like this kind of teaching because they are attached to the idea of self. This is the cause of suffering. A woman asked me about how to deal with anger. I told her that the next time she gets angry, to wind up her alarm clock and put it in front of her, then to give herself 2 hours for the anger to go away. If it was really her anger, she could probably tell it to go away like this, in 2 hours, be gone. But it isn't really ours to command. Sometimes in 2 hours it's still here. At other times in less than an hour it's gone. Holding on to anger as a personal possession will cause suffering. If it really belonged to us, it would have to obey us. That it doesn't obey us means it's only a deception. Don't fall for it. Whether the mind is happy or sad, whether it loves or hates, don't fall for it. It's all a deception. When you are angry, does it feel good or bad? If it feels bad, why don't you throw that feeling away? How can you say that you are wise and intelligent when you hold on to such things? Since the day you were born, how many times has the mind tricked you into anger? Some days the mind can even cause a whole family to quarrel, or cause you to cry all night. And yet we still continue to get angry. We still hold on to things and suffer. If you don't see suffering, you will have to keep on suffering. If you see the suffering of anger, then just throw it away. If you don't throw it away, it'll go on causing suffering indefinitely. The world of samsara is like this. If we know the way it is, we can solve the problem. The Buddha's teaching states that there is no better means to overcome suffering than to see that this is not myself, this is not mine. This is the greatest method. But we don't usually pay attention to this. When suffering arises, we simply cry over it without learning from it. We must take a good hard look at these things to develop the Buddha, the one who knows. Now I'm going to give you some Dhamma that's outside the scriptures. Most people read the scriptures but don't see the Dhamma. They miss the point or don't understand. Suppose two people are walking together and see a duck and a chicken. One of them says, "Why can't that chicken be like the duck? And why can't that duck be like the chicken?" What they want is impossible. They could wish for the duck to be a chicken and the chicken to be a duck for the rest of their life, and it would not come to pass, because the chicken is a chicken and the duck is a duck. As long as they continued to think like that, they would suffer. The other person sees that the chicken is the chicken and that the duck is a duck, and that's all there is to it. No problem. In the same way, the law of Anicca states that all things are impermanent. If you want things to be permanent, you're going to suffer. One who sees that things are naturally impermanent will be at ease and free from conflict. The one who wants things to be permanent is going to have conflict and maybe even lose sleep over it. If you want to know the Dhamma, where do you look? You must look within the body and the mind. You won't find it on a bookshelf. To really see the Dhamma, you have to look within your own body and mind. There are only these two things. The mind is not visible to the physical eye. It must be seen with the mind's eye. The Dhamma that is in the body must be seen in the body. And with what do we look at the body? We look at the body with the mind. You won't find the Dhamma by looking anywhere else, because both happiness and suffering arise right here. Or maybe you've seen happiness arising in the trees, or from the rivers or the weather. Happiness and suffering are feelings that arise in our own bodies and minds. Therefore, the Buddha tells us to know the Dhamma right here. Someone may tell you to look for the Dhamma in books, but if you think that this is where the Dhamma really is, you'll never find it. If you look in books, then you must reflect on those teachings inwardly. Only then can you understand the Dhamma, for it exists right here in this body and mind of ours. When we do this, wisdom will arise in our minds. Then no matter where we look, there is Dhamma. We will see anicca, dukkha, and anatta at all times. But we don't see this. We always see things as being ourself and belonging to us. This means that we don't see the truth about conventional reality. For example, all of us sitting here have names. Names are a convention. Of course, it's useful to have names. Four men, A, B, C, and D, must each have an individual name for convenience in communicating and working together. If we want to speak to Mr. A, we can call out to Mr. A and he will come, not the others. This is the convenience of convention. But when we look deeply into the matter, we will see that there really isn't anybody there. We will see transcendence. There is only earth, water, wind, and fire, the four elements. This is all there is to this body of ours. But we don't see it in this way because of the power of atavadupadana, or clinging to selfhood. If we were to look clearly, we would have to see that there isn't really much to what we call a person. The solid part is the earth element, the fluid part is the water element, the part that consists of air and gas together with the currents of energy coursing through the body is called the wind element, and the part that provides heat is called the fire element. When earth, water, wind, and fire are brought together, they are called a human being. When these things break down and see that there are only these four elements, where is the person to be found? That's why the Buddha taught that there is no higher practice than to see that this is not myself and does not belong to me. Me and mine are simply conventions. If we understand everything clearly in this way, we will be at peace. If we realize in the present moment the truth of impermanence, that things are not ourself or do not belong to us, then when they disintegrate, we are at peace with them. They are merely the elements of earth, water, wind, and fire. It's difficult to see this, but it's not beyond our ability. If we succeed, we will find contentment. We will have less anger, greed, and delusion. There will always be the Dhamma in our hearts. There will be no need for jealousy and spite, because everybody is simply earth, water, wind, and fire. There's nothing more to them than this. When we accept this fact, we will see the truth of the Buddha's teaching. If we could see the truth of the Buddha's teaching, we wouldn't have to use up so many teachers. It wouldn't be necessary to listen to teachings every day. When we understand, we simply do what's required of us. But what makes people so difficult to teach is that they don't accept the teaching and argue with the teachers and the teaching. In front of the teacher, they behave all right, but behind his back, they become like thieves. People in Thailand are like this. That's why they need so many teachers. If you're not careful, you won't see the Dhamma. You must be circumspect, taking the teaching and considering it carefully. Is this flower pretty? Do you see the ugliness within it? How long will it stay pretty? How will it look later? Why does it change so? In 3 or 4 days, when it loses its beauty, won't you have to throw it out? People are attached to beauty, attached to goodness. If anything is good, they just fall for it completely. The Buddha tells us to look at pretty things as just pretty without becoming attached to them. If there is a pleasant feeling, we shouldn't fall for it. Goodness is not a sure thing. Beauty is not a sure thing. Nothing is certain. This is the truth. Things that aren't true, such as beauty, are things that change. The only truth that beauty has lies in its constant changing. If we believe that things really are beautiful, when their beauty fades, our mind loses its beauty too. When things are no longer good, our mind loses its goodness too. We invest our minds in material things in this way. When they are destroyed or damaged, we suffer because we have clung to them as being our own. The Buddha tells us that these things are simply constructs of nature. Beauty appears and soon fades. To see this is to have wisdom. If we think something is pretty, we should tell ourselves it isn't. If we think something is ugly, we should tell ourselves it isn't. Try to see things in this way. Constantly reflect in this way. We will see the truth within untrue things. See the certainty within the things that are uncertain. I have been explaining the way to understand suffering, what causes suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When you know suffering, you should throw it out. Knowing the cause of suffering, you should throw it out. Practice to see the cessation of suffering. See anicca, dukkha, and anatta, and suffering will cease. What are we practicing for? We are practicing in order to relinquish, not to gain something. A woman told me that she was suffering. When I asked her what she wanted, she said she wanted to be enlightened. As long as you want to be enlightened, I replied, you will never become enlightened. Don't want anything. When we know the truth of suffering, we throw out suffering. But when we know the cause of suffering, then we don't create those causes, but instead practice to bring suffering to cessation. The practice leading to the cessation of suffering is to see that this is not a self. This is not me or mine. Seeing in this way enables suffering to cease. It's like reaching our destination and stopping. That's cessation. That's getting close to Nibbana. To put it another way, going forward is suffering, retreating is suffering, and stopping is suffering. Not going forward, not retreating, and not stopping. When that happens, is anything left? Body and mind cease here. This is the cessation of suffering. Hard to understand, isn't it? But if we diligently and consistently study this teaching, we will transcend things and reach understanding. There will be cessation. This is the ultimate teaching of the Buddha, the finishing point. The Buddha's teaching finishes at the point of total relinquishment. Don't be in a hurry to judge whether this teaching is right or wrong. Just listen to it first. If I were to give you a fruit and tell you it's delicious, you should take note of my words, but not believe me unquestioningly, because you haven't tasted it yet. If you want to know whether the fruit is sweet or sour, you should cut off a slice and taste it. Then you'll know. The same goes for the teaching I've just given you. Don't throw away this fruit. Keep it and taste it. Know its taste for yourself. The Buddha didn't have a teacher, you know. An ascetic once asked him who his teacher was, and the Buddha answered that he didn't have one. The ascetic just walked off, shaking his head. The Buddha was being too honest. He was speaking to one who couldn't know or accept the truth. That's why I tell you not to believe me. The Buddha said that simply to believe others is foolish because there is no clear knowing within. That's why the Buddha said, I have no teacher. This is the truth. But you should understand this correctly so as not to disrespect your teacher. Don't go saying, I have no teacher. You must rely on your teacher to tell you what is right and wrong, and then you must practice accordingly. In the Buddha's time, there were disciples of the Buddha who didn't like him because the Buddha exhorted them to be diligent, to be heedful. Those who were lazy were afraid of the Buddha and resented him. When he died, one group of disciples cried and were distressed that they would no longer have the Buddha to guide them. Another group of disciples was pleased and relieved that they would no longer have the Buddha on their backs telling them what to do. A third group of disciples was equanimous, having reflected on the truth that what arises passes away as a natural consequence. Which group do you identify with? These days, things aren't much different. All teachers have some followers who resent them. They may not show it outwardly, but it's there in their mind. It's normal for people who still have defilements to feel this way. Even the Buddha had people hating him. I have followers who resent me. I tell them to give up unwholesomeness, but since they cherish their unwholesome actions, they hate me. There are plenty of people like this. Those of you who are intelligent will make yourselves firm in the practice of Dhamma. So, vintage Ajahn Chah. A couple of points that just hit me while I was reading this earlier. Just in comparison with last night's reading of the Satipatthana was just where Ajahn Chah says, you know, like, well, talking about the cessation of suffering, where can the cessation of suffering be found? And he says, you know, where these things arise, that's where they cease. And very similar, you know, as one of the quotes from the Digha Nikaya yesterday was like, how does craving come to be abandoned? How does its cessation come about? And the answer is, wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there its cessation comes about. So I just really appreciate that it's right. The cessation is right there where it comes, where it arises, right at the moment of experience of anything pleasant, unpleasant, agreeable, pleasurable. That's where it arises, that's where it ceases.
I think a Dhamma would reflect some Dhamma. You have described it where it is.
Similar idea, yeah. Good analogy. Also, another thing that was, I think, a real stark analogy was when he was talking about upadana as the cause of the second kind of dukkha, the kind of dukkha that we can prevent, and using that like the regular kind of dukkha would be just a regular syringe when you're getting an injection of some medicine, but the second kind of dukkha with clinging the upadana is a syringe filled with poison. That's the one that causes death. Maybe strike. Maybe because of my nursing background. And the other one that really caught me was when Ajahn Chah says, when we know the truth of suffering, we throw out suffering. And it just hit me that's like, in order to let go of it, you really have to know it. You really have to penetrate it, understand it, and then you can let go of it. Okay, well, we'll be having more Ajahn Chah. Tomorrow we won't have a reading because it's Saturday, but have a couple more days of Ajahn Chah readings as well after that.